late September, which means it's Oktoberfest in Germany. And I brought two beers. It's a, in proper German, Franziskaner Weißbier. And the other one is by Stefan Hefeweißbier, also wheat beer, from the oldest brewery on the planet.
Now, we only got 21 more years before it's 1,000 years old.
Amazing. Have you ever been to Oktoberfest?
No, I really want to go.
I've never been.
Again, if anyone's listening, we're not being sponsored, but if we would like to be.
Absolutely. Anytime. Yeah, what do you call this in England? This whole beer pouring thing goes tits up.
I mean, you can.
Oh my goodness.
Okay. I'm so glad this is not a video podcast.
Just want to say the same thing.
Generations of Hannes's.
Maybe we should just start with the science and ignore the
okay,
really poor
let's
beer.
Just get it
on. Poor beer pouring skills.
Yeah.
So even though Chris and I work in two different groups, we spent almost the whole day today working together, which was very nice. Cheers to that.
Cheers.
Here's the bottom. Cheers.
Cheers. Yeah, it was a good day, but we spent it in front of one machine.
Which was the HPLC in my lab. And at some point, I injected something which I thought was pure, or let's say I injected mixed two pure substances, a nucleotide monophosphate and its corresponding triphosphate, which I was thinking would give me two peaks, but instead we found four peaks in the HPLC.
At least.
At least, yeah. Who knows what was hiding under those. And it got me thinking about purity of substances and how difficult it is to make a pure substance. Well, first of all, we bought this compound from Sigma.
Oh, again.
Or some other company who might not want to sponsor us anymore.
Probably not. It was really impure.
It was really impure. We should buy his stuff. And it got me thinking about how difficult it is to make an actually pure substance. Well, first, also how difficult it is to assess its purity. But on the other hand, the efforts chemists go through to make it pure.
It's pretty much 90% of my life. I do 10% of actual work, and the rest of 90% is just cleaning.
Just columning.
Columning
all day.
Yeah. Keeping something, trying to get something pure. Again, like Hannah said, the word pure depends on what you're looking at as to. Ideally, pure would mean, in a molecular sense, that only a single type of molecule is present within the container that you have. And that is incredibly difficult to do. You usually, everything will say 99.9% or 99 if you spend more money, or 99.
List of heavy metals and their respective PPM abundances.
Concentrations.
Yeah.
And you essentially cannot get something pure. You will always have...
No, all the way not, of course. But I mean, let's stay within the limits of what's possible here. And, well, I spend a lot of time purifying things to a certain degree, maybe not super high. Also,
not after I saw that trace. Jeez.
Also, NMR is a very insensitive method, so everything looks kind of clean, right?
This is the thing. You, when you start talking about purity, it's actually, a lot of it is to do with the quality of your instrumentation. So it looks pure to your NMR machine, but if you used a UV vis machine, you then suddenly see more of some other molecule that is it's better at detecting. And suddenly you realize the thing that you thought was 99% pure by NMR, it turns out by UV vis, is 98%, 97%.
For me, it's just the opposite. In UV vis, everything looks clean because RNA gives you this one super intense peak around 260, and then NMR shows you, or actually shows like 2% ethanol in your sample, which is like much more than I have in RNA, which doesn't happen a lot, but it did happen.
But it's also like you can't trust any one thing because you may have something that the machine can't see.
Exactly, like in UV. Like ethanol does not absorb in between 200 and 400 nanometers, I think, so it's just invisible, like,
invisible for you. And in NMR, if you have silicon or silica or lead, something that's not
any of these, or anything that's outside your spectral width, right?
Yeah, you won't see it. So you could look at it and be like, oh, I've got really pure stuff, and it's
big block of lead.
Yeah, could happen. But then what's the methods that you would think is best to purify things? Not only to detect the purities, but also to make a substance really pure. I think one method I can come up with from the top of my head as a, I don't want to say non-chemist, but at least not as an active synthetic chemist, would be crystallization. That usually leads to very pure.
Yes, products. Crystallization is one of the kind of considered the gold standard techniques of purification. Because it's reasonably unlikely, and I'm probably going to be shot for saying this, that a product will crystallize with anything else. It usually is enthalpically, that is, enthalpically and not entropically, just enthalpically favorable for it to form a crystal of itself with itself, rather than what's called a co-crystal, where it crystallizes with another substance. I would say usually. I think that's not that true, but
that doesn't always work, right?
It definitely doesn't always work. It's
not like a method like any kind of chromatography, you can just inject basically anything, get something out. Well, most of the time
it's difficult. You require a solid that you need to be finding, and then that you want to be purifying, and then you need it to crystallize, only it crystallize, and everything else stay in solution, which is actually kind of difficult. Sometimes you will get crystallizations where two different types of crystals will form at the same time. So let's say a red and a blue.
Pick the red one.
And then you'd have to, well, then it would be a matter of mechanically sorting through the crystals. You would go back, change your conditions in the hope that only one thing crystallized out. So yeah, crystallization only solves your problems for a very select few types of compounds. Yeah. Chromatography, like you said, is slightly more general, but still, we're only talking small molecules. Well, we are talking mostly small molecules, some...
Small scale also.
Also small scale.
Like, yeah. Can you do chromatography on a large scale?
Yes, you can. If you make...
How large? Industrially large, not like...
Industrially large. Large scale, you can do it industrially large, but the compound you're making is so incredibly expensive to do chromatography, because the amount of solvent you use and the amount of the solid phase, whatever it is,
yes,
that you use.
It's so wasteful. Yeah. All the solvents.
All the solvent has to be, well, oh. It can be re-evaporated, but all of the solid phase has to be chucked away.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's incredibly wasteful and expensive. So only compounds that are incredibly expensive, kind of like the $1 billion or £1 million blockbuster drugs that are sold over the counter, are worth doing it for.
Yeah, Factor 8 apparently has an insane affinity column for purification. So at this point, it becomes almost a social problem. Well, not social, but at least in the large-scale economy, a problem to separate molecules, right?
It's a huge problem. It is, this is something we've talked about before, but it is one of, I think, the most pressing problems that is... affecting humanity at the moment. And it's maybe a semantic argument, but you can pretty much say that the separation of things is affecting all levels of our economic development and environmental health and human health.
Can you give me some examples?
In general, so for our waste and stuff.
Well, waste is obvious.
Huge. Yeah. You want to separate back the things that you want to use.
What about water? Definitely also, right?
Yeah, water is difficult. Like, essentially, there's only a finite amount of clean water on the planet.
Yeah.
And separating, first of all, just fundamentally, separating the salt from seawater is a huge problem for areas like Dubai and these sorts of things where they don't have enough fresh water. And they are spending billions, probably, of dollars trying to extract fresh water from salt water, and it just requires an incredible amount of energy.
How do they do it? They don't distill it.
Don't distill it. They use reverse osmosis, but it's not that much better than distilling in terms of how much energy. It is like boiling cauldrons of water and condensing it somewhere else is a pretty good way of doing it. But yeah, it's usually reverse osmosis. But then you can think about all of the wastewater we produce. we can't keep just flushing that into the sea. We probably want to recover our drinking water from it. And we're quite good at it. Like, the anecdotal story is that in London, the water that you drink has passed through 7 humans before you drank it. Yeah, so the water in London, they're quite good at...
Just keep re-purifying it and...
Yeah, yeah. They get the water back. They leave behind all of the bugs and shit.
That's pretty good. It's also a very interesting way to represent it. It passed through 7 humans. It's just like, who did the math and why that math?
I think you divide the total amount of water and by the number of humans and get to some kind of...
Yeah, assuming all the water went through people, because when I shower, I don't drink all of it. Like, I shower the other side.
That's true, yeah, yeah. But then it could be a Caesar's breath argument as well, where...
What?
There's a back of the envelope calculation you can make that when Caesar was... It's a thought experiment, but when Caesar was stabbed with his dying breath, he breathed out a certain number of moles of atoms or molecules of air. And given full convection around the Earth, we all contain one of the breaths, one of the molecules from Caesar's breath, last breath. And that might be the London water argument as well. It's just, you know, some of it's passed through someone and then we drank a bit of that again and so on and so forth. So. But in general, like, moving away from the big questions like air, water and stuff like this, separating things from there is just to make things cleaner. We also, it's also a question of recovering useful elements to do stuff with. So we chuck away loads of stuff at the moment and we're beginning to start thinking about recycling, but turns out recycling is really difficult. And we can do certain things. We can recycle things like aluminium. That's reasonably well done because it's easy to find a particular property that aluminium has that nothing else has. Which you can then use that to separate the thing.
Which one would this be?
It's you pick out anything that's ferromagnetic first.
Uh-huh.
So you use
just with a big magnet, electromagnet or something.
Yeah, and then you use an electromagnet to cause an induced current within the aluminium
with a coil around.
Yeah.
The sample, the waste.
The waste, and then
so you then magnetize the aluminium.
Yeah, and suck it off. Yeah.
But is there nothing else that is not ferromagnetic, but can be magnetized like aluminium? Is that...
There probably is, but this is what we're going back to, like, 99%, 98%. In general, in the waste stream, 90% of it, of the things that are not ferromagnetic, but also can be inductively magnetic, is going to be aluminium. So it's the best way we've got, the cheapest way we've got to separate that out. I mean, one of the good ones, one of the biggest examples, and it's because we put such value on it, is gold. So I can't exactly remember the statistic, but if you took all the gold that has ever been mined in the earth, from the earth by humanity, it would fit into something like 20 Olympic swimming pools. And that we have a lot of things with gold in them and we use them all the time and they whatever is because we're so keen on recycling gold. Like, gold has a huge value culturally and economically, so we're always picking gold back out of our waste streams.
Not practically, some things, like, it's good for conducting materials.
That's about it. It's pretty useless. Yeah, exactly. As a chemist, I'm not that interested in gold.
Surfaces? What about surfaces?
SPR? I quite like that.
Yeah. It's gold surfaces, right?
Yeah. Sometimes. And gold nanoparticles have some interesting effects. But actually, as an element, gold is way low on my favorite element list.
Oh, really? Okay, don't want to dive into that, but just can you give me the number one and the at least the lowest you can think of.
I would definitely go fluorine. Fluorine's a pretty good one.
Really, number one?
Yeah, it's the most reactive element. Like, it's very difficult to get elemental fluorine out. Or
and then we go back to separation. How do you make elemental fluorine?
With a lot of electricity.
Out of what?
A lot of electricity.
Out of some
magnesium stone. Fluoride, I think. I don't know exactly what you would get. Molecular fluorine, sorry, would become as F2. But yeah. That's kind of cool.
What's the least exciting element?
Probably gold.
It's
pretty down there. It's the least reactive. So if I'm staying consistent with my method of...
Where do you put hydrogen? Is it cool?
It is cool.
Why?
it's the only element that we can accurately get all the energy levels for using quantum mechanics. So I'm kind of like, it's the one thing chemists actually can calculate properly.
Instead of, well,
doing.
Sure.
Maybe that's
not instead a matter. Yeah, exactly. Instead yeah. a matter of our theories or of the element itself or of our mathematic methods.
It's definitely an element of our lack of mathematical ability.
Yeah, I think that's just what this demonstrates. On the other hand, I think
Having that as a totem of our lack, I quite like it. I pin that on my wall.
I think hydrogen, especially in organic chemistry, is just a placeholder for an empty bond.
No, it's got other...
So often, not always, but so often it barely has any properties, unless it's somehow acidic or can form hydrogen bonds, which is often the same thing, right?
So it can do a lot of things that no other element can. Be acidic, one thing.
Yeah.
You get things like
that, right?
like hydrogen deuterium effects,
well,
which only happen because hydrogen has such a low mass. And so that is really interesting. The
yes,
isotopic
that's
difference
super cool.
Between.
But also that's just a feature of its low mass. And the acidity is also just a feature of having only one electron, which is cool because the entire nucleus, being one whole proton, can just drift off away. So then this hydrogen which goes around this H plus thing is just an
proton.
Just a proton, right? It's not even
yeah.
full atom anymore.
I
don't
know,
so that's why
I
think it's not a really cool element at this point.
I don't know, there's a lot to talk about hydrogen, whereas with gold you kind of start to hit a wall quite early.
Yeah, I think it's also interesting how I started this bit with let's not get into this.
Okay.
Let's talk about elements for a while.
Yeah.
We wanted to get back to separation of waste recycling. And for that matter, I saw something recently about a program by BASF, this huge German chemical company. And they have a program, also disclaimer, I'm not getting any money from them, but I would like to.
I'd like a job.
Sure, also that. they have this program where they turn plastics back into oil, the crude oil, and then work again from scratch with that oil,
mm-hmm.
which I find a very interesting approach because it's in a way it's the most basic, well, not basic, but the most consistent approach, right? Let's just go to step one again.
It's incredibly energy inefficient, and this is kind of
yes.
a great example of why separation is so important or so difficult for us. It's actually cheaper to take it back to step one and start again.
You mean it would be, or let's say it would be better, obviously, if we would get back to a step where the following synthesis steps would be much more easier.
Yeah, I mean, ideally, you take the plastic bottle, melt it, and turn it back into a new plastic bottle.
Yeah, which means we would have to separate all of them, and we just argued, discussed, you can't.
Yeah, it's super difficult. So,
especially, like, imagine you have your household plastic waste, you have PP, PE, PET...
Yep.
Whatever, just a bunch of plastics.
And then some of them.
I'm not even sure what all these are chemically.
No.
Yeah. We have a bunch of plastics that are basically inseparable.
They are. It's very difficult to distinguish between the individual plastics. That's
yeah,
the,
it's not like we can just have antibodies for them and
pull them out.
Take them out. Yeah.
There are. You can use lasers and robots. That does actually work.
What?
Yeah, I use IR or Raman spectroscopy. From a distance.
On tiny particles, then? Because they grind them up, the plastic.
Usually they do more on bigger sets of particles. So they'll do this before the grinding. So they'll fire the laser at the bottle, get the spectra from the bottle, and then knock it into whichever waste stream. So they can...
This is beautiful.
It does work.
It's an amazing application of spectroscopy.
I know. It's cool. But the problem is that we tend to put mixed plastics together. So even in your bottle, the bottle top will be made of a different plastic to the main bit of the bottle.
Yes.
So even if you can separate it, bottles, and even if some of our listeners are separating their plastics diligently, it won't help because there's always going to be contamination. Even plastic bottles have possibly some Coke or whatever on the inside. That's going to be a problem for the system. There's going to be sugary water in there. That will affect the industrial process that is needed to make it back into a
mm-hmm.
new plastic.
So I think that's why BASF and whoever they work with took the approach to just burn everything down, just get it back to...
Well, so that's the ultimate cheat. So they've taken their one step higher or one step up the value chain than burning. So the ultimate...
Yeah, they're not burning in the sense of...
Sweden. Sweden burns a lot of its waste and recovers it for energy, which is like the lowest form of recovery of what we what you've done.
Well, you make it sound so bad. Ooh. I thought it's kind of nice to make energy out of waste, but in a way,
it's super inefficient.
Yeah, because you get rid of the actual matter, the actual material, and carbon. Useful carbon is limited on our planet. So just, you mean just burning it, just getting out the mere essence, just the energy of it is kind of a cheap approach.
And there's like a hierarchy of energy as well. You get high grade energy, which is like electricity, which can perform a lot of useful functions, and you get low grade energy, which is essentially waste heat. And when you burn rubbish, you can't burn it at super high temperatures, so you get to a point where you just have a lot of waste heat. So a lot of houses in Sweden are heated with this waste heat, but that's all you can do with it. You can't do something useful or like run a computer off it or do these sorts of things, because it's just, and this is a question of entropy. This is that you very difficult to upgrade waste heat to a very useful form of energy. So that comes from it's the laziest option when it comes to recycling these sorts of things. I mean, ideally, yeah, you would retain the value in it and produce a pure plastic again, but you can't.
What do you think, in what extent could we in the future benefit from tools from nature? There's already at least one, I think a few enzymes that has been found in bacteria in the ocean that can degrade plastic. Mm. Do you think this could be one solution to tackle the waste problem, to break it down into more useful materials again?
Yeah, the nice thing about natural mechanisms, especially enzymes, is they're highly specific. So you know almost exactly what you've done to the molecule. So you've created a single effect, like breaking one type of bond or one certain thing. And that means that when you take what you've processed, you know exactly how it's been treated and exactly what's different from it.
So you can imagine having a huge bath of plastic that you add a lot of, I'm making up an enzyme, PETAs to it.
PETAs, I like it, yeah.
Which will degrade all the PET after, I don't know, a certain amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
Then you sieve off the other plastic that's still in there. Then you treat it with PEAs. What's left, you treat with PPAs and just so on. Is that what you were thinking of?
That's a nice example of the specificity of enzymes mean that you can be certain that only polystyrene has been eaten by the enzyme. And that's ideal. That gives you, that knowledge allows you to separate things out. And that's the game you're always playing when you try and do a separation, is you have certain properties of the thing that you're trying to find, and you can you tune the separations, be it crystallization, be it HPLC, be it using magnets to pull things off. You tune the way you're separating to the knowledge of the thing that you're, to the unique characteristic of the thing that you want. And so, yeah, that's a great way of doing it. And nature is a great example of recycling and specificity and the reuse of every single thing. Each thing can be separated again back out of it. So the kind of ultimate example of this is the carbon cycle, where the eventual returning of CO2 to the atmosphere is the final step in the cycle, returning back and using a huge amount of energy, still requires a lot of energy, but requiring the energy of photosynthesis to trap that carbon dioxide again, separate it from the atmosphere, and lock it down as a carbohydrate.
So. That's interesting. I was never thinking of it that way, that, well, we just talked about separating substances. It's so difficult and so energy expensive. And now you tell me that's what biology is doing with photosynthesis.
That's the ultimate.
That's a separation. That's just a separation process. That's
for carbon.
So interesting. Thank you for the thought.
It's for us as a society, as a species, it's the only form of energy we really, well, there's nuclear energy, but traditionally that was the only form of energy that we were exploiting, is the carbon that was trapped out via photosynthesis at some point, billions of years, but it was always that energy that we trapped and separated. And even to the extent, not only a separation of molecules, but a separation of atoms. So they were taking the carbon and ripping oxygens off it and separating only the carbons out until you get oil. It's kind of crazy. They're elemental separations.
Yeah, it is. There's one more thing that's close to my heart that I want to talk about on this entire topic.
Go for
it. Let's just get back right into my lab as we started this whole thing. which is, well, we work in two different labs, two different groups, but also Chris works in a synthetic chemistry lab and I work in a biochemistry lab, which sounds rather similar. We both work with molecules, whatever, but the hands-on things we do for you all happens in glassware. For me, it's all plastic. Is that correct? You only use glassware, basically.
Mostly, yeah. Glassware.
Yeah. And I touch glassware. I store buffers in bottles and here and there use a beaker. That's it. And I found it, well, I got to this point in maybe the lower points in my PhD and my confidence as a scientist. I was wondering, the contribution I make to knowledge, is it worth the huge amounts of plastic that I waste? God.
We throw so much waste away. Science generates the most amount of waste. It's awful. I mean, maybe hospitals have like a kind of close in terms of the amount of people. Yeah, they keep someone alive, whereas, yeah, we haven't done much.
Well, yeah, I haven't. Yeah, I mean, on a good day, I don't even use so many pipettes or Eppendorf tubes or whatever, PCR, 96 well plates, but for people who do very pipetting intense work, it can easily be several tip racks a day. Entire boxes of tips and many, many, many tubes. I often wonder, do we have to? Is there a way how we can make this more efficient in the lab? Sure, you can say, sure, it's only a few scientists, but in the end, every bigger city has a university or some kind of higher education system that has labs where people do these things. There's a lot of companies who do a lot of high throughput methods, and I don't know if they are using the same equipment as we do, but I would assume they do.
I think so, yeah. This is, like you, this is a hugely close to my heart. I find it really disheartening seeing how much waste we produce as we go about research, which hasn't got a direct link to human benefit right there and then. It's not. Eventually, it might do, but just the direct day-to-day kind of work we do, and it's a huge amount of waste.
I think it's even worse. I think we use this argument, well, we work for a better tomorrow, and we do something good. That's why it's okay to not care about the waste too much. That's why I just use another Eppendorf tube for 10 microliters, which I will chuck 2 seconds later.
Well, I found myself when I'm pipetting, the occasional times I pipette, where let's say I get distracted and I look down at the thing I'm using and I go, I can't be sure that this is clean anymore. And so it may be a perfectly good tip, but I will just chuck it and get a fresh one.
Do it almost every day.
And that's awful. That's like,
yeah, it is.
The worst thing. And this is, I think, one of the reasons what's stopping biologists use glassware is that the cleaning of glassware, you can't be as guaranteed of whether it's clean or not as the fresh plastic tips. It's very easy to make plastic RNAs free and enzyme free. Whereas when you wash in water in washing machines or dishwashers and these sorts of things, because the water comes from the tap supply, as we've already talked about, it's recycled, passed through humans several times, it's actually quite difficult to guarantee that there is no enzyme left in that water.
I think there would be an argument that people would make is biological experiments are much more sensitive than chemical experiments. And I want to say that's, from my perspective, that's true. You wouldn't really care if there's a bunch of cells in your round bottom flask, because as soon as you add
good luck to
them. DMF to it.
If they can survive my reaction, then that's a nature paper in itself. I'm happy. It's probably a Nobel Prize. Let's go for it.
Yeah, while in biological experiments, this can be a major game changer. So many artifacts, false positive, false negative results.
I would also say that I think chemists would like to use more plasticware. If they could, in the sense if they could be sure that something was clean, they would use it more than, say, they use glassware. It's just that when we work with solvents, we can't guarantee that the tip or whatever won't dissolve and contaminate our reaction. Whereas because you work in water the whole time, there's very little chance that the plastic will interact with your reaction.
Yeah, exactly. Basically, it doesn't. Yeah. Did I tell you a story from a master thesis when I was preparing an NMR sample of peptide in chloroform? And the biochemist I am, I did it in an NMR tube. And I said, there's a lot of signal here, but it doesn't look like a peptide. Took my supervisor 2 minutes to figure out which brand of Eppendorf, well, which brand centrifuge tubes I was using, because she had like the chloroform extracts of all of them saved. I was like, use this sorted tube. That's true.
Yeah. So even the plastic you use in your tips isn't pure. There's a lot of plasticizers and also just contamination from the thing. It's just that those contaminants don't appear in your experiments.
In biology, they don't really matter.
Yeah.
As soon as you add some organic solvents, at least like chloroform, maybe not ethanol. But...
And it also depends on the question or the piece of equipment you're using to determine purity. So that you go all the way back is because you cannot see the organic things that have dissolved. Well, they don't dissolve, so you can't see them. You don't mind, whereas I care a lot as to whether the plasticizer or the bits of the monomers come into us.
Well, what you're arguing for right now is it is correct the way we do it, because our experiments benefit from it. The question is, can we still retain high experimental precision and accuracy while making the entire thing less wasteful?
So I don't know, and I don't know if you want to risk the one failed experiment. I don't think you can. I've made mistakes and lost months of work, and this is it's a huge waste. So not only are you wasting plastic, but if you used glass pipettes but couldn't guarantee they were 100% clean, to waste 4 months worth of work is even more wasteful than just throwing away one plastic tip. So I'm not sure you can ask that of scientists to not be 100% certain with the items that they're working with. What I would say is that if we could recycle lab waste, and to be honest, the tip waste that you produce is actually a really good candidate for that BASF product recycle, plastic recycling system, because it's not contaminated with metal or like all these different things. It's quite a clean waste source.
Well, the thing is, it's clean chemically, but biologically, often it's not clean at all. It can be severely contaminated with.
Yeah. So, but this is where the reason why biologists, although they don't think about it, the reason why they trust plastic is because the method by which you synthesize plastic completely eliminates any biological things. So you basically distill petrol.
That's not what I meant. Okay, I was thinking of a system where we would collect all our tips.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're made from the same plastic, it would be rather easy to recycle it and to make tips out of it again.
Yeah.
However, let's say someone works in a BSL free laboratory with malaria or something like that, and these tips are contaminated and dangerous for everyone who works with it or who would work in the recycling process with them. So these would have to go in a separate waste. Or maybe you could even argue they cannot be recycled because they are biologically contaminated, which I don't think is actually true. I think with the right measures and methods, we could do it. But the regulations right now say they have to be incinerated.
Yeah, and that might be a prudent... that might be like the overcautious method for making sure that malaria or like some ridiculous disease doesn't get out. But I completely agree with you. I think you could design a system. But like I said, the nice thing is that with, say, you had all the plastic of one type, the way you would recycle it would be using high temperatures. So you would be getting above 200 degrees C, no matter what. And you may have a catalyst in there, but you would certainly have some solvent around, DMF or whatever, to like properly destroy the biological thing that is in there. So you've got quite a good area with which you could work with.
I fear it wouldn't even be so hard to collect these things.
No, they come in the tip box.
We have very few different objects in the lab. In my case, they are centrifuge tubes of 1.5 ml, 15 and 50 ml, which we call Eppendorf and Falcon tubes. Please send me money.
But even or, in the separation
or tip box, tips and... Then maybe in the cell culture, there's also whatever 96, 24, 12 well plates and then petri dishes and all these things.
Even just like a simple sieve in that case can probably get you quite a good separation. Like all of the Eppendorfs will come through one hole, you know, versus whatever.
Well, I try to do that. It's not so easy to get the liquid out of an Eppendorf.
It's
stuck in there. But well, with a smart enough machine with rotation, whatever, it definitely works.
Mm-hmm.
No question. Well, the ultimate question is, even if there was a company offering that service, and making labware from recycled labware, would you be the researcher who says, yeah, I try this. I use my grant money to invest in greener labware?
So this is the ultimate problem with all recycled goods, is eventually it has to be economic. It will be economically driven. So I would only be say yes to that exactly. if they were cheaper than the virgin plastic
yes.
system. And currently it's not economically viable to separate and recycle plastics like
because of entropy.
Because of entropy. Because of the eventual energy and entropy cost of trying to do that separation. So it's really, really tricky and really, really expensive, and currently is only really used for pharmaceuticals and these sorts of highly expensive things.
Well, I really hope someday there would be a nicer way of dealing with our consumables in the lab, because right now I feel I'm so wasteful, and might be imposter syndrome, but I don't even feel like I'm producing anything.
No, I think it's the slow turning of the research wheel. It still needs to go on in order for the final big goal output
right,
to be
and since
produced.
It keeps going for so long,
there's a lot of plastic waste.
Exactly. We should maybe make sure that along these turns of the wheel, we also think sustainable. And I think that's way of thinking that's not really present in the labs, because everyone is so focused on getting grants, publishing their papers in Nature.
Yeah,
do.
No one thinks about the impact. There's very little out there on that, and what the kind of your physical impact of your research, not in the societal sense, but in the kind of environmental and the amount of trash you produce.
Yeah, I really hope this changes at some point. I hope we will witness it before Wein Stefan's Brewery celebrates its 1,000th birthday, which I want to attend.
Yes.
And with this, I want to close the session for today. Thank you, Christopher, because I will have to go home and bake a cake for tomorrow's group meeting. It was a pleasure.
Nice.